Hi guys.
Hi Chris, how you doing?
I'm
Evening,
good.
Chris.
Hi, Phil.
Evening.
Were you waiting there long? Sorry, I just got distracted with the questions and I forgot we were
No.
waiting for you.
Instantly forgettable. No, not long at all.
All right, that's good. That's good. I already have banned any talk of Chelsea today, Chris.
Good. Yeah, very wise. Yeah.
Did you go to the game?
No, I didn't. I can't bear myself to watch the games now. It's awful, isn't it? What a fair weather supporter I am after however many years, I don't know. But no, I couldn't bear it. I listened to it. I did listen a bit of it on the radio, but then that was too stressful, so I packed that up as well.
If
Yeah.
anyone's happy that Chelsea lost, can we just have some orange emojis or wolves emojis? That would be
That's
great.
very cruel.
There we go.
All right. Well, today's episode, we want to talk a lot around genetics in football, probably prompted mainly from a podcast that I listened to, which then I took a clip from it and then posted it up. And it was this guy, Chris Williamson, who's like brilliant. He does the Modern Wisdom podcast. And he was giving stats on what is down to genetics and what is down to environment. And one of them that was interesting was 80% of our height is genetic, but 20% environmental. So that was very interesting. He's also done a podcast quite recently, which was investigating, and this was quite out there, but there seems to be a fair amount of data that supports it. But it was all looking at how much our genetics influence social status. So that was a fascinating episode. But bringing it back to football, I want to start having this conversation. Well, I want to have this conversation today where we really dive into how much is predetermined down to genetics. So, Chris, I'd like to put this to you to start with. And I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, but yeah, we're going to focus a lot of this episode today on it. In your opinion, how much of becoming a footballer is down to your genetics?
So what do we inherit? We inherit certain physical characteristics from our parents, and I think you can see in very young kids some who are very fluid movers, for example, physically literate because they have good hand-eye coordination. Part of that will be genetic, part of that will be inherited. So there is a basic level, I think, of physical capacity that is going to be inherited. But that only gets you started. It doesn't even get your boots on, sort of thing. I think that gets you started. So, in terms of talent, we can say, I don't think very much of it is inherited. I think there's that physical capacity. There might then be the things that you're taught in your early years, the lessons that we all get, the very early life lessons, which are really important. But that's actually that's nurture, isn't it? Rather than nature, if we've gone past the birth point. All the rest is about work and practice and an application. So certain basic physical side, absolutely. We talked about goalkeepers before, haven't we? And you look at their parents because if you want them to be tall, well, they're either going to be tall or they're not. And that obviously, a lot of that, as you've just said, Sean, is genetic. But so much of it, all the rest of it, is work and it's practice and it's interest and it's commitment and all those things. Talent is mostly hard work.
I've got quite a few kind of like counterpoints, but I want to open it out to Matthew and Dan before sort of like coming back to me. But yeah, I think it would be good to sort of like hear from you both quite broadly to start with, like your just initial like thoughts. I mean, Dan, like what's your thoughts on this subject?
I think it gives you an opportunity. Parents, sires, clubs looking at it, scouts looking. However, you have to develop your talent. So, regardless, you can have the tallest players, the best athletic parents, sorry, the tallest parents, and you'll get a tall son or daughter. But that, again, has just given you an opportunity. You then have to develop that talent. And it's sort of what's more important for me is what they can develop off the field as well. Are they coachable? Are they good at taking on information and holding the information? So I think with regards to the parents, yep, a lot of scouts look at it, but that just gives you the opportunity because you get so many boys and girls nowadays that have their growth spurt that are like Bambi on ice, just finding out their sort of their coordination. So although it might make them stand out and in a game, they might stand out and it gives them that opportunity, but I think it's the talent and it's the training that will develop the player.
Yeah, 100% agree with Danny. It gives you a bit of a head start potentially, but ultimately you can be caught. I mean, we've all played with and coached with players that at 8, 9, 10, 11 were incredible, didn't apply themselves, didn't have the right attitudes, and then got caught up. So there's genetic ceilings. You know, if you're, you can spend as much time as you want developing your speed, but you're only going to be so fast. Like, there is a genetic ceiling to how much you can develop. But any day of the week, I think any coach would take somebody that might not have the natural physical capacities over somebody that's determined, relentless, works hard, loves the game, is willing to do anything to improve over the player that's a little bit quicker at the moment, naturally, but doesn't have those mental characteristics.
All right. And yeah, I'm in general agreement with what everyone said.
But.
Well, if so many players have got a good attitude and are coachable and have hard work. So like, if that is kind of a benchmark and most people have that, and I'm thinking like we are recruiting from 6, 7, 8 years old. So, and there's only space for 16 to 18 kids in the group. So let's say everyone is a great kid. They're all hardworking. You know, they're good parental support. Well, now, what does it come down to? And then, yeah, you know, we talked about it last week that we kind of like attributed £55,000 per player, which was quite sort of broad math, but roughly that could be what it's costing each player. So if you're going to gamble on a player and you've got the choice of a player who looks like they have high athletic potential, suited for football, and good attitude, good kids, look like they have good technical potential, then you're going to go with that kid who's got the higher athletic potential.
Suited, yeah, for football. The academies, like, I have this conversation quite a lot. Academies have to draw a line. Like, academies do get a lot of stick for only picking certain types of players, but they can't take on 50 players. Mm. So they have to draw a line in the sand and they have to make their decision and they're investing a huge amount of money into it. So it's down to them to do what they want because it's their money. And at that moment, a lot of the time, they would lean towards exactly what you just said, Sean. Somebody that's, you know, if everything's equal, then the player that's shown a little bit more natural athletic ability, then they have every right to lean towards that. So the bigger question, and it kind of goes beyond, I guess, maybe what we're talking about, but the bigger question is, I personally don't think the academy system is maybe as good as it should be. So I've spent some time at Ajax and their system, from what they tell me and from what I saw and experienced, is just so much better. They work really closely with grassroots clubs. So I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Chelsea have days where they invite lots of grassroots clubs to come to the club and put on CPD events for grassroots coaches.
Yeah. I've done loads of those over the years. But
they'll flip that as well. So the academy coaches will go into the grassroots clubs, put on sessions for them. So then there's just much more, belief amongst grassroots football in Amsterdam. They know that academy coaches are out there and being active in the grassroots scene, and it's an easier pathway into the academy.
Okay. I mean, yeah, but that isn't... And yeah, you did say that you were going off on a little bit of a tangent there, but like bringing it back to just kind of understanding about genetics, the importance of genetics in football and how much of a factor that is today in becoming a footballer, I'm thinking that it's a massive part of you know, development now. Like, quite a bit of it's quite predetermined.
I think it's very much recruitment as well. It's a key aspect with regards to recruitment, and I think it gives you an advantage. So where you were saying, yes, majority of the players are going to be hardworking, great attitude, blah, blah, blah. It's that 1% what makes someone different. And that slight advantage might be the athleticism. It might be the size of their parents. And I think this discussion, in my opinion, is mainly for foundation and development phase players, because they're the ones where it's, what are they going to be like once they've had that growth spurt, once they've had the physical change? I think with older players, it's about the skill then, because size-wise then, it's what's their decision-making like on the pitch, how smart, what's their football brain like? So I think genetics is very important, and a lot more, there's a lot more discussion about with younger players.
Okay, so two things that you talked about there. We've got like the recruitment. I think that there's now more scouts than ever before. So, and Chris, actually, I think you said this last week, that pretty much if you're seen to be having enough potential and what the clubs want, you're going to be seen, because there's so many scouts out there now. So there's people are being seen, the players are being seen. So there's less people being missed. So now, and coaching is getting better. Coaching now, that has been such a leveler, because it's almost like everyone's got the same chance of pretty much, because you can go and find good coaches that are almost everywhere. So then everyone's got the same chance of being as technical, really, as a, like, under eight. Like, if you're able to go to, like, a really, really good coach and, like, dribble between cones really well, pass the ball well, shoot well, all that kind of thing, from the hours of practice and good coaching, then, yeah, like, that's an even field. And now it's, like, clubs are basically out there, and this is where people get upset about this, and I see it in the comments where they're like, oh, the scouts are just recruiting athletes and then turning them into footballers. Is there wrong with that? Like, I don't.
But there was also, Sean, there's also clubs, also academies, where the academy managers or directors will say to you, look, we've got too many of the same type of players, and they're often technical players. I could take you now to an academy not too far from where I live, where they're crying out for the more athletic players. They feel they've got loads of smaller technical players. So it does vary. The other thing that varies, I take your point on choice. In the cities, there is more choice, and you've got more local clubs to choose from, and you've got more academies, 14 academies, probably more than that in London itself. But in the country areas and elsewhere in other countries as well, there is less choice, actually. And people don't feel that, oh, well, if I don't get on here, I can get picked up there. So they're still desperate to find ways to get noticed. Now, I go back to what Dan said. I think in the early, very early stages, that athleticism will go a long way. But once you're in the system, so we've gone past the recruitment bit, now you're in the system, who is going to succeed? I think you could say, if you look at certainly the best academies, at 16, they're all good players. They're all pretty technical. They've got a good level of ability. For me, what picks out the ones at those ages who are going to go on and make a really good career is not so much the technical or the physical, because they've all got that level by then. To an extent, you could argue slightly differently about pace. It's character and it's desire. You know, you take a Reece James and a Conor Gallagher, they weren't the best in their, I've said this before, they weren't the best in their age groups at 13 or 14. But they had that drive and that desire, and they've gone on and had international careers. Whereas other players in those same age groups, probably technically more gifted, maybe even physically, because Reece was not the most mobile, I think it's fair to say, Sean, in those ages. But he worked and worked and worked. And so I think there are different stages, aren't there? Recruitment, getting in the first place, that athleticism, pace will always be an attraction, you know, and a good bit of that's going to be genetic. Once you're in the system and that you're surrounded by other people who are at the same sorts of levels where the physicality is concerned, then I think more and more, the older I get, the more I see this, it's more and more about character and desire when you get older that differentiates those who really make it to the top.
And can I just say on that point, with the from under 16s, when they're in year 11 to when they go to full-time football, 16 to 18 as scholars, the best players don't always get the pro contracts, because that is when I have seen through my years in academy football is the biggest change in players, because that's where they need their character the most. When you're at the training ground every day, you're doing your football and education every single day, and talent isn't enough. And I know there's loads of quotes about talent, but once you're in full-time football from 16 years of age, it's not just about your talent. You need to mentally, psychologically, you have to be on it. And it's your character from when you're getting to the training ground at 8:30 for breakfast and you've got education in the morning. So,
okay, so let's say we talked about it with the England group last week, where we said that the majority of players, something like over 80%, had been in their academies before the foundation age. So then let's say that all the players who seem to have like the most athletic potential or most potential, they're the ones who've been like into the program. And that, like you say, Chris, gets you in the door. Once you're in the door, you're with best facilities, best coaches, playing best matches, and that you're just going to keep improving. So the players on the outside in grassroots are finding it harder and harder to catch up. And statistically, we see very few players from grassroots step into academies. And it happens, it definitely happens, but it's on the lower end, the higher up you go in age group. So it's like the genetics is what gets you the opportunity. And then then all the other stuff, do they have enough character? Do they have enough work rate? And all the other stuff that then helps them make a career. But it's probably is harsh, because there's some kids who are those early developers that look very effective. And there's another kid who potentially when they go through puberty, they match the other player athletically. But what happens is that the academy can't see that. And it's so hard. I mean, God, like, you don't have a crystal ball. Like, you kind of maybe judging, we said last week that there's a bit of like looking on the sideline and looking at parents on the eye, and then you're making a call on it, and you never would have predicted that that kid would have got athletically as strong as they did, or tall as they are, whatever it was, once they went through puberty so late. So then they don't get all that good training, which then is very like, you know, it's impactful for them through their career. So that's why I'm saying so much now is down to the genes.
I'm just trying to think, the parents that are listening, some are obviously at academies, some aren't, and want their child to fulfill their potential. Something I've been leaning more towards recently is to potentially identify your genetic ceiling, and then start thinking about that. Because if you know, if mum and dad are really honest with themselves and they can look back and say, we were never in the sports teams at school, we never played a decent level of sport, so there's a good chance that our child isn't going to have those the genetics that some of us might have. We need to maybe double down on other things.
Yeah.
And accept that our chance at an academy is going to be when he's under 14. Like, and not push the academy route, but double down on what your strengths are going to be, tailor the training more towards that, maybe start specialising in the position a little bit earlier, and hopefully we get to 14, growth spurts happen and everything else, and can this player then be a standout player for his intelligence, for his passing range, for his decision-making, everything else, and maybe that's how they go.
Sorry, there's lots of comments that are happening as this live's going on, and just a couple of them, to listen back or watch back this podcast and the other podcast, you can go on YouTube and search Project Footballer. And if you go on Spotify or iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and type Project Football, you'll be able to listen back to it. And I think Sean made a very valid point. He said it just before somebody typed a comment. Yes, a lot of this conversation is about academy players, and there's quite a few parents that are putting questions here about grassroots players. And we are going to be very, very honest. I think Sean was very honest here. Some of the parents, when your children are at elite pathways or development centres, and the coaches sell you the dream, or you're there for 6 to 12 weeks, Sean has made it very clear, sort of realistically, how difficult it is the older you get to get into academy football from grassroots. So the genetics that we spoke about for pre-academy foundation phase, which is sort of 6 to 11 years old, once you're 12 and above and it's sort of a development phase, like Sean has said, if you're a grassroots player and you want to get into academy, it's even more challenging. So just to say that grassroots parents understand, sort of, although we're talking about academy football, the opportunity to get into academy from grassroots is so difficult.
Yeah. Matthew, I was telling you about my friend from America, and like she was telling me how she was an elite swimmer when she was growing up, and then she was very good, doing really well, got to 15, and like her body just changed and it wasn't suited for swimming. And basically, you know, she kind of had to give up, like she reached her ceiling. And it's perfectly accepted. It's just like, but I said to her, I was like, yeah, but if your parents wanted you to get into, become a pro swimmer, and they're putting all that effort, did they not think that that was going to happen with like your shape? Like, you know, you're not necessarily suited for that. And I don't know, like she just started swimming, she liked it, she got into it, and then just carried on. But I think, I mean, it happens in ballet, it happens in loads and loads and loads of different sports. Probably not so much in like, in chess, you know, badminton. I don't know, there's some others that it's not as strict on the sort of like genetic criteria. But I think that sometimes people see football as very much a game for all, but I don't know if it is. I don't know. I mean,
you mentioned swimming. You like Michael Phelps. Is Michael Phelps, well, one of the reasons he's Michael Phelps is because of his wingspan. Shaquille O'Neal was one of the most dominant basketball players ever because he was 7'2" and 130 kilos. I think maybe given what we know now, like it's not 25 years ago when we all used to play, maybe a little bit longer for Chris. maybe 27, 28 for Chris. But yeah, given that what we know now, it's maybe parents can have a more kind of honest look at themselves and start to plan ahead a little bit more and just say, oh, you know what, I was the quickest player in my school. I know I've got great genetics, and oh, you know, yeah, my partner was, she was also the quickest girl in her school. So we know there's something there. Let's work with it, or the complete opposite. It's definitely, and I think I don't want to get too far away from genetics as well, but it is the, Danny mentioned it last week as well, it's just that having that healthy outlook on your approach to youth development, because you can't, like, the biggest determining factor to make it as a professional is luck. I believe it's luck. You can get injured, you could have a really bad coach, like there's so many things along the way that you can do everything right and something out of your control happens. So you,
this has to be a topic for next week.
But yeah,
that,
sorry.
That
so,
quote there.
Yeah. All right.
But so if your outlook, like I said, Danny said it last week, like you've got to have a healthy outlook on youth development and your journey. And you can argue, you know, is the end goal to be a pro? You could argue that maybe you don't want it to be your end goal. It's your end goal is fulfilling your potential.
Can I argue a bit about that, Matt, though, on the this concept of a genetic ceiling? I absolutely take your point where basketball is concerned and I know people who are very involved in professional rugby, and they say, well, they don't really start seriously looking at players until they're 15, 16, because they just don't know what shape they're going to be in terms of what positions they could play. Absolutely get that. Swimmers as well. Football, I think, is slightly different. But one aspect that I want to challenge you on, because it's a challenge to me as well, is this the concept of a genetic ceiling where pace is concerned. I was brought up assuming and being told you're either quick or you're not, basically. You can refine it, but that's it. You're either quick or you're not. Now, through my business scouting game where we assess players, we're often referring players to strength and conditioning work. And we only refer them to one strength and conditioning coach, and that's Ruben Tabarez, because I think he's the best. And but Ruben will argue with this, because he says it's possible, just something he threw at me, he said we can improve anyone's pace by 20%. Now, that's mad. If that is absolutely across the board, when I, as a scout, have been writing people off saying, hey, he's just not really quick. And if it is, if there is more capacity to that can be refined and honed with the proper athletic training and conditioning, I've been writing people off too soon. And maybe we talked people out of that.
Like,
I don't know.
Sorry, do you mind if I jump in, Matt?
Go on, you're probably going to say what I'm going to say.
I love to see. So, as I understand it, we have a split of fast twitch fibres and slow twitch fibres, and some are more predominant than others, yeah. Right? So, obviously, people can get faster. I truly believe that as well. But if you've got so much, if you're so dominated by slow twitch fibers and you improve by 20%, that 20% might not be enough. I mean, Matthew, if you don't mind me just like making the point that we talked about like earlier, where you were talking about Harvey Elliott.
We watched the game earlier against Liverpool. Trossard turns him, and so Trossard has the ball at his feet and he's dribbling, and Harvey has lots of space to run into, and Harvey didn't get near him. And he just,
if Harvey, just a massive... Harvey had the ball, wouldn't he have run quicker? I think it's here with so many players, you know, Matt. It partly is pace, but a lot of it is intent. Yeah. When your team's in possession, players can usually run a lot quicker than when they're chasing, even at the top level. But however, I digress.
Yeah. Well, on Sean's point, it's I think you've got everyone can get quicker. Like we've spoke to Jonas. Top speed coach, we spoke to Ruben. Everyone can definitely get quicker. But yeah, like Sean said, there are natural limiting factors, and not just muscle fibers that Sean went into, but like biomechanics as well. So again, Usain Bolt could only do what Usain Bolt did because of his lever length and his torso length. And I saw a study on him, and they broke him down to the millimeter, and it was his stride length in comparison to like his shoe size, to his shin length, to his femur length and his torso. Like, he was built to do exactly what he'd done. You could have got anyone else to do exactly what he'd done in terms of training and everything else, they couldn't have done it. So yeah, everyone can be faster, everyone can be quicker, you can improve agility, but I definitely know there are just some people's body shape, muscle fiber type and everything else, they're naturally...
Do you mind if we because obviously like, you know, Dan, like you and I spent time like working with Harvey when he was younger. So absolutely, like we're going to root for players that we've spent time coaching for and been involved in the journey. You know, like we support them. I think Harvey's like brilliant. I was like his first scout to like pick him out the parks. So I support him. But working at QPR at that time, we didn't have the best group. We're honest about that. The other clubs would get all the best players. Back in when Harvey was getting his group signed, they had like Ben Elliott and Ethan and all these other like top under eights. And we managed to get a good under eight group. It was a very small group. But where Chelsea at that time were looking at Harvey, and he was very, very short, he wasn't quick at that time, and they were undecided, and the dad said, well, we don't want to be in a place that aren't sure about him, and yeah, managed to show that QPR was a good environment, and obviously there he signed there. I saw like the intelligence that he had and the amazing technique, and I was like, that is a player, we've got to sign him, you know, but I could afford to do that at QPR, whereas other clubs maybe not. But who's been proved right? I don't know. I mean, like, if you go on Twitter, the trolls and everyone is being like quite harsh on Harvey today, saying that he can't run, and like, you know, is he gonna get a career in the Premier League? Like, if is he gonna be able to establish himself? I don't know what's gonna happen with him at Liverpool. Is he gonna be able to establish himself in that side? Maybe not. Maybe he'd get transferred, but would he be able to get a career in another team in the Premier League, or does his running capacity not suit the Premier League? I mean, I'm opening that out to you guys.
I did scouting reports on Harvey when he was about 13, 14, and I wasn't impressed with him, particularly as a player then. He always had good touch, good left foot, but he didn't affect the game enough. But then I saw him at Fulham when he was, before he got the move to Liverpool, where Chelsea were looking at him, along, everyone was looking at him, and he had really kicked on. He had really improved. That shows the one of the issues of scouting. You can watch a player and then they change. This is what Dan's point is. There's such a lot that can change. But then I saw him, at around 16, and he had improved such a lot. He was like Eden Hazard, the way he would beat people and cause problems to teams and so on, and was really difficult to play against when he was really at it. So that was quite a change I felt for him. And so whenever that happens as a scout, I look back and think, did I miss something when he was 13 and 14? Well, I don't think so, in the sense that, like, you can only go on what you see, but he certainly did improve. And we have to say, he's playing in a top side now, and he's got a very good career. If Liverpool decided to sell him tomorrow, they'd get a decent amount of money for him as well. He's having a great career, and he's going to go on and have a great career now, whether that's with Liverpool or what he does. And that has, he's worked at his game, and he has worked at the positives about his game and made them even better, I felt, over that time. Because the things that were really wowing me at 16 were the things that I thought were quite good at 13, 14, his touch, his ability, and he can beat people. He still wasn't super quick, but he was, you know, a low centre of gravity, and he was still causing problems. He just seemed to me to have worked and improved on those positives, even. Not necessarily, you know, he hadn't, like, to take Matt's point, he hadn't sort of grown into a completely different shape and, you know, was now a Usain Bolt and legging it down the wing. He was not ever going to do that. But he just worked at the positives so much that I thought he really stepped up a level, and he's gone and done very well. So you know, good luck to him. Shows the difficulty of picking players out at different ages, though, which is Dan's point, when you just don't know what they're going to develop like when they're...
Dan... And because I think it's helpful to just like stick on this sort of conversation around Harvey, because he's quite a unique player physically. And so it's understanding, will we get more players like that in the Premier League, and like what position they'll play? I mean, yeah, what's your thoughts on Harvey, Dan?
I think Harvey has his strengths. And I think what you're always going to get on with the trolls is somebody that isn't rapid, they're going to be battering him, say, he cannot run, this player is not fast, they can't do this, they can't do that. A player that is really quick and doesn't have great end product, the trolls are going to be saying everything that they're doing wrong. I think every player has their super skill, what they're really good at, and Harvey's got his. Pace isn't it. Pace isn't where he's going to be put through on goal and is a... Who's the Tottenham centre-back that everyone was raving about yesterday with his pace? There's a Tottenham centre-back who's like, he's got the stats for the third quickest player in the Premier League so far this season. Harvey, stats-wise, isn't going to be a rapid player, but it's what else he brings to the table. And whether that's just connecting players, whether that's his movement out of possession or playing through the third, it's... he's got other areas that he brings to Liverpool, and
but if he's costing a goal, so Matthew, I didn't actually see the game, but Matthew, you said, I'm gonna say what you said. You said he was at fault for that goal. That's what you.
I didn't say he was at fault. for the goal.
Oh, one second.
I didn't say he's at fault for the goal.
This is, if he was consistently at fault for goals or consistently losing the ball or consistently his pace was an issue, then that's something the club will look at. Bruno Fernandes has lost the ball the most amount of times for Manchester United for the last 2 years. For the last 3 years, he's created the most amount of opportunities. So you're going to see it one way or the other. So if he's consistently losing the ball, consistently the pace is an issue, then Liverpool have enough stats where people in charge to know these are the areas that he needs to improve. And I think today, like every player, is going to have a bad day at the office.
Yeah, to clarify, Harvey's a local boy, so I'm rooting for him. I want him to do well.
Yeah.
At that point, Liverpool had a player sent off. Harvey got caught out of position because Liverpool had 10 men. And then he got found out in a 1v1 running race against Trossard and he couldn't catch
and
up.
Their,
but because
Diaz, their centre forward, was playing at right back.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's also
Yeah. But because I mentioned it to Sean, because we often discuss, pace of players. We talk football. So it's just something to note. Harvey, a player that we know, was caught out there because of a lack of pace.
So then the people that chose not to sign Harvey back in the day, are those people sort of like clapping their hands, going, see, I was right, he's not a player. And then going forward, clubs will say, we don't want players that are going to be a liability here. But I get your point, Dan, if the strengths are so strong that their weaknesses is you can afford to have occasional liabilities and you just manage that. But then, if it's
difference with professional footballers and the higher level you go are the errors and mistakes they make are minimal. You're not going to get these Premier League players that week in, week out are making consistent errors. Goalkeepers are mainly going to be the ones because it's goals scored. But in terms of losing possession and the mistakes, mistakes and errors that they make are minimal.
If you look at that game, take the Arsenal-Liverpool game, the other goal that Arsenal had scored where Van Dijk and Alisson absolutely made a hash of it between them. It was just awful, sort of park football mistake level. No one's going to be saying, well, Van Dijk's no good as a centre-back or Alisson's no good at a goalkeeper. It was just an awful mistakes by them. But Harvey, as Matt said, was with Diaz, was in a right-back position, not in his normal position, and they did get punished for it. So it would be unfair if fans picked him out when the other goal, two of the best defenders in the Premier League. I think Gary Neville made this point, didn't he, that you could argue that Van Dijk is the best centre-back, Alisson possibly the best goalkeeper in the Premier League. And between them, they made a complete hash of getting the ball clear. And let Martinez was it have literally an open goal to score in. So everyone can make mistakes. I don't think there will be any pattern of Harvey making mistakes that are going to lead to goals in that way. And he will create things. If he was part of a sale today by Liverpool, how much would they get for him? I don't know, 40 million, I guess, given his age and where he is. Well, that's a success story. Jeez, worth 40 million. That's terrific at his age. He's a success, but so cruel at that level, isn't it? That he will get trolled when he'll be picked out as the scapegoat. Maybe
He's going to have a career. He's going to be a successful footballer. He should be completely so proud of his journey. That's taken so much hard work.
Yeah.
I think around the sort of same time. I think literally back to how Harvey won. How he was when he was 7 years old, and then like Michael Olise when he was 7 years old, they're like opposite ends of the spectrum. Michael, when you picture him playing at grassroots level, just like probably like the perfect football athlete.
He was like a thoroughbred, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was just like a racehorse. He's just like...
That's it. So then you're looking at how he sort of is so coordinated, how he can do his step overs, how he sort of glides across the pitch. Everything's effortless. Whereas for Harvey, very, very clever, amazing kid, in terms of everything like on the ball and character and personality and all loads of other stuff, but a lot harder work. And so then I guess he's probably had to work harder. Actually, I mean, that's hard to say, but I'm just thinking, like, Michael, in the foundation phase, definitely, Michael would have had an easier ride coming through foundation phase compared to Harvey. Harvey would have had to fight and scrap, and then that's because Michael would have had the athletic advantage due to his genetics, whereas, yeah, Harvey was impacted by that. It's interesting, but I'm very interested to see the pattern of what types of profiles, athletic profiles, start to become through. Because if managers look at team sheets on the weekend and say, oh yeah, there's a liability there, okay, let's say Harvey is playing in the center, and they'll say, oh yeah, we can have our player run him there and he'll get the better of him. And so then they see that as a vulnerability. Managers are going to want to reduce their vulnerabilities as much as possible. And so ideally, you're going to want to have perfect athletes in every position if you can, and obviously great decision makers, and great in carrying the ball and touching the ball and all the other things. So then that will then filter down to the scouts recruiting, and then everyone else and the coaches coaching. But if we are saying that there are, if we're honest, that if we're saying that, yeah, there are genetic ceilings, athletic ceilings, then clubs will sort of be more rooted. Sorry, they'll be aiming towards like bringing in these types of players.
If you look, I think, at that game, Sean, the starting 22, yeah. And I haven't looked at this. I'm just, you know, what do you guys think? How many of the starting 22, Liverpool, Arsenal today, well, 180 or above, let's say 6 foot or above. Now, on sheer numbers, my guess would be, other than, you know, Isaka, Jorginho, you know, Diaz, the great majority of the players, at least I would have thought 2/3 of the players would have been 180 or above. So if that's, say, 14 out of the 22 or whatever, you know, are 180 or above, well, then that shows that you know, there's going to be more of those athletic players, in a sense, all the way through. That's the way that football is. It doesn't mean there's no place for the smaller players, for the Harveys or the Diaz or whatever, the Saka, certainly, for example. That they all have their place, but on sheer numbers, you're going to have more athletes, the bigger, more athletic types. I don't mean to be disparaging the smaller ones saying they're not athletes, but you know what I mean? The taller, more classical athletic shapes, there's just going to be more of them, because there's more of them that get selected at the end. Because as you say, if you can have a good footballer who's also a good athlete, why wouldn't you? So you do, you know, so that's going to be reflected all the way down. And it doesn't exclude the smaller players, but there's going to be more of the athletic six-footers and above, who move really well and lean, fit, athletic types. There's going to be more of them. It's because it's a lean, fit, athletic game at the top, isn't it? If you go to other levels where the pace and that isn't so important, or that mobility isn't so important, then you get different shapes of players, don't you?
But, you know, I think when Diego, hard pill for parents to swallow. Sorry,
but Matt. I was going to say one thing, like exactly what you mentioned, Chris, because there's a bit of a misconception that bigger athletic players aren't as good technically. It's exactly what you just said. Like, if you have two players and they're both very, very good football players and one's slightly more athletic, then why wouldn't you pick the more athletic one? But there's a bit of a, yeah. I mean, I'm sure you've all experienced it, that whole, oh, they're only at an academy because of their size and because of their speed. It's like, no, they can play as well. Be honest with yourself. Like, they are quicker, but they can also play. Chelsea and aren't going to take somebody that's just an athlete. They're taking an athlete plus a football player.
And this is what parents have to understand. Instead of being sort of stubborn and thinking that they know best, it's for them to realise that every football club, from Cat 3 to Cat 1s, have seen it all. So if they're not just going to keep a player because of their size. They're going to keep a player, yes, because of their size, but they see potential. So every type of player, whether it's small, stocky, baby fat, rapid, no touch, a club are not keeping a player for one specific reason. They obviously see there's potential. And I think a lot of parents that like to send me DMs or come in the comments about, or say stuff in the comments about, the clubs, whether you like it or not, the clubs have seen it. And yes, they will make mistakes, but the clubs know what they're looking for. And depending on what sort of their philosophy is and the type of players that they're looking for, just because someone's tall or is a certain type of player, they're not going to keep them just for that. They obviously see something that can develop over the next few years.
That's it. And like, parents can obviously develop their child. You know, Harvey is a perfect example of a player who was not quick and not tall, and he just was, you know, great at football, and he practiced probably more than most players out there and loved the game probably the most, more than most. And he worked so hard. And at the point around 12, 13, I know personally that his dad was doing so much work for years on just pure speed work. So Harvey probably is the very fastest that he can possibly be. And he's done that. But I think it's a case of understanding, being self-aware to understand your kind of like genetic position, try and be like as honest as that as possible, and then say, all right, we are at an athletic disadvantage here. There is a genetic disadvantage. So we're gonna put in this work. But I think it's also like understanding, is the work like worth the risk? And I always say that. I think that you've got to be so careful if you're going to chase the football dream, which is so much work and so much effort. Potentially, could that effort be used somewhere else? And football is not chased as in the like, chasing the pro game, because some kids have got more of an advantage than others.
Sean, can I? To put a question to Chris, one of the comments here was about academies keep players to pad the one or two they are really looking to develop and progress. You can't play a game of football with two players. That's from your soccer vault. Can I have your thoughts on that, please?
If only we knew for certain which the one or two were, then we could do that, I think. But you never know. You're going to have in any academy squad, any age group, you're going to have, however you categorise it, your A players at that time and your B players, and you're always assessing them. All coaches are always doing that. But nothing is set in stone. So I don't know any academy that thinks, oh, let's just go out and get, you know, it tells it scouts, people like me, I'll just go out and just get anyone so we can, you know, fill some shirts out sort of thing. Because, you know, we're really focused on this one or two. Because it just doesn't work like that, because you never know how people are going to develop, and you're always trying to strengthen squads. You don't purposefully pad them out with average players. I don't think anyone would settle for that. Yes, at any time, you could look at a squad and say to the coach, okay, who are the two or three that you think are the really top ones here? And they'll tell you. It doesn't mean that the others are just there making up numbers, because in a year's time, because of all the things you talked about, Dan, the different potential and growth, as Sean is saying, you know, a half and work and work and work, they might be a different two or three. And we see that a lot. So you wouldn't have that set in stone. I don't think any academy is filling shirts in that sense. You can you're always looking to improve the squad overall. And yes, there are players you think, well, we can release them if we can get better. I think we can get better, or we've got better. Now we can release them. There's this evolving nature of a squad. But I wouldn't agree that the academies sign players to just pad out numbers. I don't see that happen. Don't recognise that.
No, and I think I've heard and I've had this conversation with many parents where they feel, yes, there are, and every parent can see it, the coaches see it, there will be the top three players and then the next group of players. Now, a lot of parents, like that comment said there, feel that the coaches are just developing them three players. What the parents need to understand is, with puberty, growth spurts, injuries. If they were to just concentrate on them three players, two of them get injured, one has a growth spurt and loses their coordination. So it doesn't work like that in academy. And the academy, this is a business. They're not there to be your friends. It's a business. So the more players they can develop and eventually sell or bring into the first team, the club make more money. So if they were to just concentrate on three players, they're limiting their potential income and success rate of players into first team. So I understand your soccer vault point, but there's a bigger picture with the clubs rather than concentrating on three players, because they're investing a lot financially into development of the whole squad.
Yeah. And again, I come back to, you know, Reece James and Conor Gallagher at 13, 14 wouldn't have been in the top three. Mason Mount probably would have been in the top three, I think, probably all the way through. Ruben Loftus-Cheek probably would have been. Callum Hudson-Odoi. But not all the players are. It changes, you know.
Alfie Gilchrist?
Sorry? Alfie wouldn't have been. Definitely. No. And how well he's doing now, Sean, you know.
Did he play,
and
play today?
Yeah, he got on, yeah.
Yeah. How did they do?
I thought we weren't going to go there.
We've got a question. When someone here said, I want to understand what this person means. Players are chosen and given preferential pathway. Obviously, they won't say that. What does this person mean by that?
Because the top three players, he's talking about the top three players will be given a certain pathway.
If you've got a special talent in your academy age group, then of course you're really proud of that and you're very excited about them. And you might say, if you know, the phase lead coach says, and you're a coach, well, we need someone to play up next week because we're short of players, you might push, well, this lad's doing really well. You know, that's fine. That's development. It's not going to be set in stone, though. I think, you know, that same player may not be the best one all the way through. So I don't think it necessarily works like, you know, it's not fixed in that way. These things do change. And so that's where I think people make a mistake. But of course, there's going to be those that are doing better at any one time, mm-hmm. and they might get more opportunity, may get more game time, depending mm-hmm. on, you know, the academy organise it. That's, you know, players have to earn the right to get those extra opportunities, don't they? And it doesn't suit everyone to play up either, of course. That's another subject. But sometimes that's seen as a reward, isn't it, for someone that's doing well, which is a very dangerous way of looking at it, I think. But nevertheless, opportunities might come for those who are doing really well at that time. And that's to be expected. Like, as you were saying, Dan, it's a competitive arena. It's elite sport. It's not sport for all in that sense. You're looking to develop players. In academies, we're not there to develop teams. We're there to develop individual players who, as you say, go in the first team or get sold or whatever.
Yeah.
Of course, as coaches, you always want to develop teams. You always want to do well and compete now.
Yeah.
But it's individual players that will be judged on at the end of the day.
Definitely. Using the comparison of playing roulette and you're looking at your chips and kind of like you're going to have more confidence in some chips. Some chips you're going to say, you know, that's like a golden chip. And maybe it's a bigger chip that covers more numbers or something, you know. Like some of the players, yeah, you can kind of like hedge your bets on those ones. It's not someone's put in the comments, nepotism. Like, no, like that. It's not nepotism. It's that this child is proving themselves to show that they seem to have the most future potential. So, yeah, and they also need to be challenged. However, like you said, it doesn't suit every child to get pushed up. I found out today that Cole Palmer never, ever played up a year. It's quite an interesting fact.
Did he play today?
He's gone! Do we want to do questions for the last
like, 2 minutes? I was going to say, if I was to throw, could you put a number on genetics, as in, use 100, and out of that 100, how much potential is the genetic makeup? Is it 30 or 40 out of the 100 for the player? So the other 60 or 70 is down to their coaching, their training, their yeah, their determination, everything else outside of it. So then if you've got a player that naturally, let's just use the number 40 for a second. So 40% is genetics, 60% is environmental makeup. So if you've got a player that's kind of 30 out of 40 for the genetics, but then only 20 out of 60 for the environmental makeup and nurture part of it, and then you've got the other way around, where you've got somebody that's got 50 to 60 out of the nurture part of it, but only 10 to 50. So what could you assign like a percentage to the genetics?
I think it would depend on the age, Matt, not to avoid the question.
But that's very good.
At the young age, 6, 7, 8 year olds, to put a figure on, like 60 out of the 100 might be.
I was thinking
70. I'd agree on that. Once they're in the system, going back to what we said before, when they're in, then I think things balance up a lot.
You know?
And then it's about how they respond, how they develop, how they work, and maybe, as you said, about how lucky they are as well. All the other things come in. And it shifts down to 30, I think, later.
When me and you were talking about this, Matty, on the phone, and you were saying to me how I come across like I'm so much around nurture, and then the stuff like I've said around like Messi and Messi being like down produced because of circumstance and environment. Like, I absolutely do believe that the circumstance and environment contributed hugely to who Messi is. And the example that I gave was that you could have another player that's been out there at some point in the last like 100 years, or let's say the last 50 years, who almost had like the exact same genetic makeup as Messi. So let's say, you know, similar knees, like height, speed, Messi got to 18 miles per hour. Let's say like almost the same, maybe like, I don't know, the same kind of like brain, but the environment that Messi was in and the circumstances and all the other stuff made him who he is. So yeah, that's kind of like, I don't know if that helps explain it, but that's kind of like,
and look,
Chris's Messi's
the second best player in the world, so look how great that makes him.
He's so controversial.
Makes him. But one last thing, just to end,
but Cole Palmer's not quite there yet.
Remember, you can listen back to these on Project Footballer on YouTube and Spotify or Apple podcasts. So yeah, there's been a few questions about where can they listen back to last week and this week. And so yeah, that's that.
Dan, I know you operate doing one-to-one sessions as an individual, but do you have a company name that you're connected with? What's your...
I used to. However, I now just work for myself now.
You're just Dan.
So just
as we're like wrapping up the episodes, we can give our plugs. we always help that. Chris, you said that, you know, quite a few people reached out to you in the week.
Absolutely. I got an assessment from a parent in America on the basis of whatever the rubbish I'd been speaking about the last time we did this, last week or whenever. Just this week. So yeah, it works. And for the scouting game, doing independent player assessments and all around the world. Next one I'm doing is Kazakhstan, player from Kazakhstan. Can't wait. This will be really interesting.
Gen football. Oh, we've lost reception.
Oh no, you're back. Go on, what did you say?
Yeah, so you're Gen football.
Gen football.
And
hopefully we're well known enough that people know about it.
Hopefully. And for myself, we make footballers for children, for coaching for children aged 4 to 12. I'm sure we have a centre at somewhere in the UK for your child. Cool, nice one, guys. Thank you so much for that.
So I was going to say, it is important to know, obviously, the importance of genetics, but I'm just very wary that people are going to tune off and give up and just think, oh, so much is based around genetics. It's not. Like we said, you can get faster, you can get more agile, all of that stuff you can improve. And then exactly what you said, Chris, I like the way that you looked at like the continuum. It's, at that pre-academy age, it might be largely grounded in kind of genetics because it's so much athleticism. But as you move up the age groups, the athleticism becomes less and less important. The genetics become less important in terms of that. So then if you are younger and you're not at the academy level, but you know it's your dream to become a pro, just think about how you can do it and what's the long journey. Getting into an academy at 9, 10, 11 isn't the be-all and end-all. We know the stats. You've got a better chance. But what are your strengths? All right, I'm not going to be 6 foot. You know, my parents are both 5'4". I'm not going to be 6 foot. But I can definitely be quicker. So let's go out there and get quicker.
Yeah.
Work on the things that I know that I'm going to be better than. I can do all the training in the world. Me and Danny could do the same thing. Danny's going to be more agile than me because I'm taller. It's just biomechanics. So you can look at your strengths and plan ahead and plan for the long term.
Well, perfect.
And on that note.
Nice one, guys. Have a good week.
Ciao.